As indicated last night, this morning we shall talk about further aspects related to the sitting meditation, to the walking meditation, and then also with regard to the general activities, and then we'll cover a few points concerning the interview, and then at the end there will be just some general remarks. Now, yesterday we discussed the sitting posture, how to sit, then also a few things about the breathing, and then there was mention of the primary object being the rising falling movement of the abdomen. Now, the rising falling movement of the abdomen is the primary object, and this does not mean that it is the one and only object to be observed, but rather it is kind of the anchor to which the object that we start sitting with, and then when some other predominant object occurs in the body or in the mind, and then we shift our attention to this new predominant object, and then we observe it and we try to know its nature. Once that object has disappeared, then we return our attention back to the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. Now, with regard to any predominant object, there are three aspects that are worth considering, both during the sitting itself as well as for the interview, namely, occurrence of the object, number two, the labeling plus the observation of the object, and number three, knowing the nature of the object. Now, these three aspects will be explained one by one, and by occurrence of an object is meant just the arising of some predominant object. And there's nothing much you have to do in this regard. An object will arise all by itself. Now, when it comes to the second aspect, especially the labeling and the observation, well, your input is required, your effort is necessary. And so when a predominant object has arisen, then you try to label it with a soft, gentle mental label. It does not mean that you have to say these labels out loud. If you were to do this, your neighbor might, your neighbors might disagree. And then if everyone would be doing this, then we would have a hum of some labeling going on. Now, in terms of the labeling, we try to find the most simple word that certainly comes to mind, and it's really important to know that you don't need to become experts in labeling. This meditation practice is not about finding the right words, but it is much more about a proper observation of the respective object and knowing its nature. And so, at the beginning of one's meditation practice, it might be at times a little bit difficult to find the right label, the right word for some sensation or mental object. But with time and practice, gradually you will become more and more familiar with these labels, and gradually you will also accumulate a so-called vocabulary of descriptive terms. And then later on you don't have to think much about this anymore. Right away you'll know how to label. Now, The labeling helps a meditator to clarify for himself or herself what the object actually is under observation. So there's a huge difference between, let's say, tension and then stiffness and hardness. All three of these are sensations, yes, but they're different sensations. And so it's good to know the differences and keep in mind that when it comes to objects of the external world, we are in the habit of giving names to them. So when we see a tree, we say this is a tree. When we see a bird, we say or no, this is a bird. When we see some human being coming, then again the mind will recognize this. And it certainly will know this is a human being. And same thing goes then to differentiate between the different human beings. We every one has a name, and thus we know human beings according to their respective names. Now, once we have labeled an object, then we go on with its observation. But maybe still one more aspect with regards to the labeling. Sometimes meditators think that when observing an object like the rising movement of the abdomen, they need to label it in a machine gun type labeling. So something like rising, falling, pain, etc. Now, if you were to do this, then would this support your observation and knowing the nature of the object or not? Not at all. So please don't go for this kind of labeling. Just one or two gentle labels are, for in the case of the rising movement and falling movement, are quite enough. So the way it happens is the rising occurs, you label it once as sudden rise, and then you'll have plenty of time to observe it and to know its nature. Same thing goes for the falling. Now, if you have, if an object arises like a pain, and the pain lasts for a longer period of time, then the procedure would be okay. You label it as pain, and then you observe it, and you try to know its nature. After a couple of seconds, again, you label it as pain, and then again, you observe it, you know its nature, and then after a while, again, you label it, and so on and so forth. And so, if the object then eventually disappears, then resume the observation of your rise and fall. Now, far more important than the labeling is the actual observation of an object, and this is the work, or this is where mindfulness comes in. And when an object has arisen, then we try to be with this object from its very beginning through its middle, through or to its very end. Now, at the very beginning of a retreat, this might not necessarily be possible, and it might well be that a meditator can observe clearly only the middle portion of an object, and then gradually, maybe later on, also the ending portion, and then again later on the beginning phase of an object too becomes predominant. So see how it goes. And so when observing an object, well, then you want to know this object you want to observe it as carefully as possible. Mindfulness wants to sink in the object, and certainly it wants to keep the object in view. It wants to be face to face with the object. object. And in this also, you want to be with the object as quickly as possible and as thoroughly as possible. You want to grasp and cover the object as best as possible. These are all some aspects of mindfulness. Now, then when it comes to the knowing aspect, you try to know the nature of the object. So then what is your or how's your object manifesting in terms of, let's say, some physical sensation? First of all, what sensation is it? Is it hardness? Is it stiffness? Is it pressure? Is it heat? Is it cold? Is it warm? And or various kinds of movements, etc., etc. And then in terms of mental objects, well, what particular kind of mental object is it? Is it a particular mental state? Or maybe just some general vague condition? And then does this particular object, does it last for a longer period of time without changing? Or is it changing, etc., etc. Now, the Venerable Sayadaw Pandita of Burma has certainly clearly stated among the three things, namely, or three aspects, the occurrence of an object, its labeling and its observation, and knowing its nature, well, the most important aspect is knowing the nature of the object. Now, if at times you miss to label an object, that's okay. Then at least make sure that you can observe it properly and that you know its nature. Now, better than this certainly would be to label an object, to observe it, and to observe it. And even better than this would be to label an object and then to observe it properly and certainly to know its nature. Now, those three aspects of occurrence, labeling plus observation, and then knowing the nature of an object, these are three aspects you can apply to any predominant object. And you can check for yourself, okay, which object has occurred, and then furthermore, am I really labeling this object or not? Am I really observing this object or not? And what am I knowing about this object? If you find that you're not labeling, okay, then maybe it's time to resume the labeling. If you find that you're not observing properly and your mind instead is somewhere else, then it might be a good idea to put more effort into the observation itself. And if you find that you are labeling and observing but you're not really knowing anything about the object, well, then check what is happening and then trying to make the necessary adjustments so that you clearly know something about the respective predominant object. Now, last night, briefly, I mentioned about certain wandering mind, which is a very common phenomenon among, not just among meditators, among all human beings. And so, even though we may be holding a PhD in this or that particular field, yet we may find in our meditation practice that our mind is wandering or not wandering. Huh, Mary? It is wandering. And even though we may be holding a PhD and we're masters of great masters of logical thinking, yet when we actually sit in meditation, then we find that quite a number of our thoughts are very far from being logically connected one with the other. So And sometimes there's a lot of nonsense coming up in the mind, in the form of wandering thoughts, and sometimes there's random thinking going on. Sometimes it may be topic-centered thinking. At other times it could be obsessive thinking, on occasion the wandering mind may be quite reduced to a minimum. Now, when it comes to your wandering mind, then, and if it is suddenly really predominant, then take it as an object, label it accordingly, and observe it and try to know its nature. Now, at first you might want to be somewhat specific in your labeling. So if you happen to, or if the mind is planning, then just label this as planning and then observe and know. Or if you find your mind is going off into the past and it's remembering all sorts of events that happened 45 years ago and which seem so important right now, label this as remembering, and or you might label it as getting lost in memories, and so observe and know. And later on, you might discover that in the end, whether it's planning or remembering or analyzing or reflecting or fantasizing or imagining, etc., it all boils down to one thing, namely wandering mind. There you go, or thoughts, or thinking. So, very simple. And so, then we can just use this general label as thinking or thoughts, and so, this then is quite enough. Now, there's more to say about the thinking, and in particular, the thinking has one rather difficult tendency. One thought easily leads to another thought. There you go. Another thought, and then does it stop there? No, it does not stop there. And it leads to a third thought and a fourth thought. And eventually we say it has become a train of thoughts, like one of those long freight trains with 32 carriages. And after a while, we no longer see the connection between our first thought and the last thought. Now, be careful with this tendency of the mind to go on thinking in terms of associative thinking, to think about one thought and then this leading to another and yet another thought. Now, still some more with regard to thinking. For the most part, human beings tend to get lost in the content of their thoughts. And so, rather than paying attention to the fact that the thought has arisen, just the phenomenon of the existence of a thought, the attention goes to the content of the thought. And this has a tendency of pulling us along. And so, as Vipassana meditators, our approach should be one of not paying much attention to the content, but rather just to be aware and to note that once again thinking has occurred or is occurring, and then we're mindful of this, and then we know this. And so, when we gradually get more and more detached from the content of our thoughts, then it will be less likely that we get hooked into these thoughts. So if you find that you're caught up in the content of a thought, then try to detach yourself from this, or try to disentangle yourself from this, and step back occurred to some extent. Now, last night I also mentioned about paints and eggs, and the four major aspects of observing paints and eggs were given, such as knowing the quality of a paint, then its intensity, and then furthermore its location and duration. Now, usually, especially after, for beginning meditators, when a pain arises, we get all agitated, and we see a pain as a friend or as an enemy. As an enemy, yes. And does it always have to be like this? Not really. And so, when a pain arises, then try to embrace it, see it as your friend, and then without any aversion, without developing any aversion towards it, just label it, observe it, and try to know its nature and stay with it. Now, especially for beginning meditators, when a major pain has arisen, there is a tendency of quickly changing one's sitting posture in order to get rid of this pain. So when I change my posture, pain is gone. So I found a solution to these pains. But this is not really a good solution, because it's depriving you of really knowing something about the nature of this pain. So please, when some pain arises, don't change your posture right away, but rather stay with it for a time, and so and then with much patience observe it, and change your posture only when a pain becomes excruciating, and you decide when this point is reached. And then do feel free to change your posture, but please do so slowly and mindfully. Now, if we were to change our posture every time a tiny little pain has arisen in the body, then what will happen?
Keep changing.
Then we will keep changing our posture. Yes, is correct. And so changing once will mean that we will feel tempted to change a second time, a third time, a fourth time, and so on. And this will be very positive for the development of concentration. Not at all. And this will make it really difficult to develop concentration. Now, please don't believe everything I say, and check for yourself at least once, and experiment, and then you will then find out. Now, an aspect that was not mentioned last night owing to the general tiredness was, and an important aspect, was the continuity of mindfulness. Now, see, mindfulness is probably the most vital or the most pivotal factor for the development of one's meditation practice. And this certain particular aspect cannot be overstressed. Meditators oftentimes underestimate this continuity of mindfulness. They think, if I practice in a leisurely manner, then I'll be quite all right, and I'll have big success in the meditation practice. Not so. And if one's mindfulness is somewhat discontinuous, kind of a stop and go affair, and on and off affair, then the overall mindfulness will be relatively weak, and this means that your observing power is weak, and this in turn means that your knowledge about the object will also be weak, and your overall development and practice will be slow. And so this cannot certainly be what we want, and so hence, please, from the very beginning of our retreat here, work on this continuity of your mindfulness. Now, coming onto a retreat means that right away we are we possess certain perfect continuity of mindfulness or not, Lisa? Not at all. So this continuity of mindfulness has to be developed, and we just have to know at the beginning it will be somewhat poor, it will be pretty discontinuous, and then we don't get certain, we don't judge ourselves certain for this, what a poor meditator I am, again I've missed to observe the object in a continuous manner. Not like this, but rather we our understanding of ourselves, and also forgiving, and then we try again with much patience. And if we keep doing this moment after moment, hour by hour, day by day, gradually our mindfulness becomes a really powerful mental tool. And you will see that your mindfulness becomes extremely sharp and also extremely quick. And as a result of this, then the mind can pick up many details. Now, mindfulness itself is not the only mental factor that we need for our meditation practice. Can you think of other relevant mental factors apart from the mindfulness? Effort, yes. Effort, what else? Concentration, yes, I agree. And?
Energy,
effort, yes.
Trust.
Pardon me?
Trust.
Trust, general trust in the practice, faith in the practice, yes, good. Well, what about an object? Let's say the object is here, our object of observation is here, and our mind instead is aiming in that direction. So we need one-pointedness, which is concentration. But before this, we even we need proper aiming. We need to aim our. We need to aim. We need to turn our mind in the right direction. And so aiming is certainly necessary, and certainly it's something that needs to be developed over time, and then gradually the mind gets the point. Now, this aiming in the Pali scriptural language is known as vitakka, and it is the Venerable Sadhu Pandita Bhimansa of Burma who likes to, or who stresses this particular aspect of vitakka in the context of the Satipatthana meditation practice. Oftentimes, vitakka is well known among Samatha meditators as one of the jhanic factors, actually the first one. Now, as at least two of you have mentioned a few moments ago, mindfulness needs to be accompanied not only by aiming but also by energy or effort. And this in Pali is known as viriya. And what this effort is doing in a real practical sense, it is pushing or propelling your observing mind towards the object of observation. So it's that force that gets your observing mind to travel all the path to the object itself. Now, vitakka, viriya, need to accompany the mindfulness, and then when those two mental factors are there, then the mind will be in close contact with the object, and it will be rubbing the object. So it will be very close to the object, and this is what is necessary. And this particular aspect then again is one mental factor known as vichara in the Pali scriptural language. In the context of the Samatha practice, it's is the second.
Is that investigation?
Investigation, you can call it like vitaka vichara. It's a sustained application of the mind on the object. And so mindfulness, then accompanied by this aiming, accompanied by effort or energy or effort, and then as a result of this rubbing is there, then what happens? The observing mindset will fall onto the object again and again, and certainly with this, then gradually the mindset will be fixed to the object. It will be glued, sticking to the object of observation, and certainly with this, the mind certainly respective mental factors become unified, conglomerated, and certainly hence we then speak of concentration or one-pointedness. And so when all of these certain factors are present, then the natural outcome of this will be what? Well, concentration we've mentioned already, one-pointedness. And what follows? What
wisdom,
there you go. So intuitive wisdom will arise. Now, maybe this much certainly in terms of the sitting meditation. Now, a few further aspects related to the walking meditation. First of all, the walking meditation is as important as the sitting meditation, so please do not neglect your walking practice. And especially at the beginning of a retreat, meditators are encouraged spend, first of all, to alternate sitting with walking meditation, and then to spend an equal amount of time on walking meditation and on sitting meditation. So let's say if you sit for 1 hour, then try to do your walking meditation also for 1 hour, and then again you sit for 1 hour, and you again walk for 1 hour. Later on, when your practice is deepening and you feel sitting meditation is getting, or more is happening in your sitting meditation than in the walking meditation, then you could increase your sitting a little bit. And there might be other times when your walking practice is stronger and something you want to do more walking meditation, then go for it. So just a very general guideline with regard to, not just with regard to the walking, but also sitting and mindfulness and general activities, is it tends to be really good to follow the natural development in one's meditation practice. So just listen to what happens in your practice. Get a feel for what is happening, what the new development is, and suddenly then go with this. But of course, observe certain limits. And so if at times you're not quite sure how to proceed, well then communicate with either Marcia or with me. Now, the three forms of walking meditation were theoretically explained yesterday, or at least described yesterday, and so I will demonstrate them in a few moments. But before this, let me mention a few other points that are related to walking meditation. Now, first of all, when you do the walking meditation, please keep your posture upright, and when you do your walking meditation, there's no need to look to check whether your toes are still there or not. And if you keep doing this, then you will end up with what? With a stiff neck, there you go. And meditation practice is not meant to lead to any impairment of one's health. Now, then when you choose a path for your walking meditation, then choose one that is maybe 5 to 10 meters long, and then without any unusual goal, or without wanting to reach any particular destination, you simply mindfully walk up and down this path. Now, sometimes it happens that, especially in places where, or in centers where there's very little space for walking meditation, some meditators, they crisscross, or their path crisscrosses with the path of other meditators. So they tend to take much delight in crossing the path of every other meditator who is doing walking meditation, and the other meditators will like this a lot or not. They don't like it for the most part. And so, now, interesting to note in this connection is that once we've chosen a certain path, then we consider this as what? My path. And to dare not come or dare not cross my path. And just be aware of this. And we're all guests here at the Synergia Ranch, and we can't take this path alone. And so, to avoid certain social friction, choose a place where you're not going to interfere with others, and then do your walking meditation as well, and in a rather focused manner, and also in a meticulous manner. Now, last night I mentioned already, formal walking meditation is not the same as leisure walking. And leisure walking we can do anytime outside of a retreat, but this kind of formal walking meditation is something rather intense, and an activity that is designed to in the end bring about the arising of intuitive wisdom. Now, not just wisdom, but also as an extension of maintaining the continuity of mindfulness. See, in a sitting you're trying really hard to make your mindfulness continuous, is that correct? And so then, once you get up from a sitting, then do you want to throw your mindfulness all away in one shot? Obviously not. So you've put in much energy into developing a certain continuity of mindfulness during the sitting, and so this then you want to carry over into your walking meditation, and you want to maintain it at least, if not improve it even further. And the continuity of mindfulness developed during a walking session, this in turn you then want to bring into your next sitting meditation. And in this way, then the sitting meditation complements the walking meditation, and the walking meditation will then contribute to the next sitting meditation. Now, kindly try to do your walking meditation as slowly as possible, and you will discover that the slower you do your walking meditation, the more details will you be able to pick up. And kind of a microcosm of footness sensations will arise in the feet or in the legs. Now, racing around, you will make it really difficult for yourself to know what is happening on a very subtle level. Now, during the walking meditation, the restraint of the senses is important, highly important, and And as much as we can, we try not to look around. And even if we hear some loud sound or noise, then we just briefly label as hearing, and we don't even turn the head around and don't look at this object unless it is something threatening. And one way of intensifying the walking meditation would be to, either in one's room or outside, to find oneself some empty wall where no one else is sitting or standing, and then to support oneself against the wall by with the help of a hand. You close your eyes and you do your walking meditation really slowly, and so with closed eyes, there will be less certain sense impressions bombarding the mind, and so in this certain way, it's much easier to concentrate, and you'll see it really helps to pick up tiny little details while you're lifting, moving, and lowering and placing the foot. So if you like to give it a try and see what happens. Now, let me demonstrate the three forms of walking meditation. And so we'll start first of all with the standing, so upright posture, and then kindly keep your hands in front of the body or behind, and preferably don't walk around like this. Now, sometimes people do this. This actually, when you walk around like this, then what do you think? Is mindfulness of arm movements there or not? It's not there. And so keep your arms either before or behind, before the body or in front of the body or behind it. So then, as for the first kind of walking meditation, when the left leg moves, we label as left step, and then when the right leg moves, we label as right step, and then again left step, right step, and then again left step, right step. And so, when you do your walking meditation, fix your gaze at a point maybe 3 to 4 meters in front of you. And like I said, there's no need to keep looking at your toes. Now, when you get to the end of the lane and the body is standing, then take the standing posture as an object, label this as standing, and then observe the predominant sensations that occur in the feet, and then try to know the nature of those sensations. Then, when turning, shoot an intention to turn be obvious, okay? Then include this in your labeling and observation. If not, then just focus on the turning process. So, in an ideal case, it would be something like this: intending to turn, and then followed by the turning. So, the turning process. So, you label this as turning, and again, turning, turning, and then while standing, again you label as standing, and then you observe the different sensations occurring during the standing posture. Now, for the second kind of walking meditation, we divide one step into two parts, lifting and lowering and placing of the foot. And then we want to do the second kind of walking meditation really fast or somewhat slower. Slower. And then, do we want to take big long steps like this, or that maybe like a stork? Well, neither of those. neither of those, but rather we want to take short steps. And the foot really doesn't need to be lifted off the ground too much. And so, one more point. In the walking meditation, especially during the second and third kind of walking meditation, you want to focus your attention on on the foot which is moving, and not the other one that remains static on the ground. At first, for the first 2-3 days, this might be somewhat complicated, and you might say during the interviews, oh, there's so much happening in the other foot, yet try to bring your attention back to the foot which is moving. Otherwise, your attention will be going back and forth, and that kind of makes it difficult to concentrate. So, now, at the beginning of the lifting process, we label as lifting, and then slowly, the heel will come off the ground, and then we know the different sensations that are involved. And then, as the foot is lifting vertically, we know, let's say, some heaviness, at first maybe some lightness, and then some heaviness, gravitational force which is pulling the foot downward. Now, and then comes the lowering process, so we briefly label this as lowering, and then while the lowering is going on, we try to know the different sensations, maybe some tingling sensations in the foot, and then again a pull downward, and then highly interesting comes the moment when the heel of the foot touches the ground. So at that point, please pay really close attention, and don't do it just in an automatic or mechanical way. And so when your foot first touches the ground, do you experience hardness or softness? Do you experience certain roughness or smoothness? Is there heat there or cold or warmth, etc., etc.? And then as your heel is being placed on the ground, it might happen that some pressure arises. It might happen that the pressure gradually spreads out over the entire heel, over the entire foot. And so then just observe and know all of this. Now, the same thing for the right foot, and so we label as lifting, and so, then we pay attention to the lifting process. So the heel which is coming off the ground, and certainly with this, some release of pressure might be observed and known, and then maybe there's some stretching sensation in along the middle of foot, the sole, and certainly then there might be some hardness, maybe a little bit of hardness in the ball of the foot, and then we're ready for takeoff. And then at that point, at first there's maybe some pressure, some weight on the toes, and so as the toes are preparing to take off, then the sensations increasingly become more lightness, and then finally we're airborne. And then as you're lifting the foot, know the different sensations, maybe again some tingling, some heaviness, etc. And then comes the lowering process as described early on. So one more time. So lifting, and suddenly then lowering and placing. Lifting and lowering. Okay. So when we come to the end of the path, and we're standing, we again label as standing, and then we observe the predominant sensations, we know their nature, and then when turning around, there might be first the intention, so the intention to do so, we label this as intending to turn, and then we label as turning, turning, and again turning. And one more time, turning. Now, in As for the third form of walking meditation, we divide one step into three parts, so lifting, moving and placing, and first and third part has been explained already, and the second part is not much new, so lifting process, and then at the beginning of the forward movement, we label as certain gliding or pushing as you like, and then pay attention to the predominant sensations as the foot certainly glides forward. And you might find, especially during the first few days, this forward movement is actually not that easy. Oftentimes meditators find it difficult to spot certain sensations there. Later on, as mindfulness gets stronger, then this gets easier. So there might be some numbness in the foot, or there might be some tingling sensations, or it may be cold or warmth, and then also pay attention to the movement, and then what about the stability of your foot and the body, is it there or not, and then finally the lowering and placing. So one more time, lifting, and then the forward movement, and then the lowering and certain placing of the foot. And then at the end of the path, we label as standing, and then we observe the standing posture. So that's about it for the walking meditation. Yes, I guess that's it. Now, briefly, maybe one or two more points related to mindfulness during general activities. So this is an area where there's much to be explored, and once again, try not to underestimate this mindfulness in general activities. And so we have a tendency of doing certain activities in a rather absent-minded manner, and as a result of this, we'll be missing so many details, and we'll miss chances to develop our mindfulness. When it comes to mindfulness of general activities, again, you want to do things as slowly as you can, and you will notice in the course of this 1 month retreat, at first this mindfulness of general activities will be rather coarse, and later on, as your mental faculties develop and get stronger and stronger, you will be able to pick up so many more details during your mindfulness of general activities. And it can become rather intense, and also rather rewarding. And so slowing down general activities is important, and if there's any area that you find you're not really paying attention to, then include this in your practice. So sometimes it may happen you're taking a shower, and suddenly the attention is more on, let's say, the mechanical movements of applying soap, etc. And then instead of this, try to bring mindfulness to this activity of taking a shower, going into the shower cell, and then mindfully turning on the water, and then applying soap, etc., etc. No, and then when the water flows over the body, then know the different sensations that are involved in this. Now, as for the interview. Well, our today there won't be any interviews. We'll start with regular interviews tomorrow, and all of you will be seeing. We'll divide the group into two subgroups, and then one half will be seeing Marcia one day, and me on that same day, and then the groups will change. Now, maybe the very first thing as a preparation for the interview would be, after a good sitting, you might, if you find it necessary, want to write down your meditation experiences. I do recommend this, especially for those who have a somewhat poor memory. And the details really do matter. Now, if you have a perfect computer or memory that is similar to a computer, then you might not certainly need to write down your experiences. And when you write down your experiences after a good sitting and after a good certain walking meditation, then please do so in a chronological manner. So kind of following the event, major events within one sitting. So starting from your first observation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, and then you take it from there, then maybe some wandering mind occurred, and then you're back to the rise and fall, and then maybe some pain occurred, and then you're back to rise and fall, and then maybe you're overcome by sleepiness, etc. And then when for your report during the interview, you may want to stick to just three principles, such as being as accurate as possible and as brief and as precise as possible in your description of what you actually observed. And so the report ideally should consist of one report on the best, on your best sitting meditation, and then also a report on your best walking meditation. Now, sometimes meditators are not quite sure what is my best sitting or my best walking. Sometimes all the sittings are difficult and it seems there is no best sitting. So in this case, just take that sit which best reflects the latest development in your practice. And best doesn't necessarily always mean pleasant experiences, it may also mean some very difficult experiences. So if something is really predominant and maybe also occurring quite frequently, then you want to pay attention to it, and you want to include it in your report. Now, early on, when talking about the walking meditation, I mentioned three aspects to pay, to keep in mind while observing objects, namely the occurrence of an object, the labeling of it, its observation, and knowing its nature. Those three aspects you can also use very nicely for when structuring your report. So you say such and such, during the interview you could say such and such object occurred, and then you labeled it in such and such a way, or you mislabeled an object, and then you observed the object nicely, and then this is what you found out about the object. Now, when giving your report, there is no need to indulge in very, let's say, very sophisticated language, especially no need to include some, really complicated Pali terms. Like when observing the rising movement of the abdomen, I came to know its anicca nature, and then when the falling was there, oh, dukkha was so predominant, and then the pain was there, and anatta was just really very distinct. So please, none of this is necessary. Rather than doing this, And straightforward, simple English words describe what you observed and what you came to know about the respective objects. Now, when you come in for the interview, please keep in mind that the way you walk in there will to some extent reflect what is going on in your meditation practice. So if you come, rushing into the interview area, your meditation teacher might make an educated guess that possibly you're quite agitated and maybe not all that mindful. Maybe at that moment you forgot to be mindful. That's already part of the meditation practice. Now, one really practical point is that since we don't want to waste any unnecessary time, the times for the interviews will be scheduled every day, and be ready for your interview even a few minutes before the scheduled time, and then when you hear the bell or similar sound, then come and sit down. And even if the other meditator ahead of you is still reporting, or either Marcia or me is still giving some advice. In this way, we can save some time. Otherwise, the time it takes for, let's say, one meditator to finish his or her report, to get up or to bow down, to get up and get out and leave the interview area, and then for the next meditator to come in, bow down, then start reporting. This can easily take up 3, 4, 5 minutes. And if we have to do this with every meditator, then our interviews will go until
midnight.
Yes. And there's still other things to be done. And so when you give your report, then just highlight the talk on the major development in your practice. And as mentioned earlier on, you want to start with a description of your rising falling movement of the abdomen for your sitting meditation, and then you describe the other objects as they occurred in a chronological manner. And if certain experiences repeat, you've described a certain experience already once, then there's no need to report on this a second time or a third time. And then, when it comes to your, the interviews in general, especially regular interviews almost every day, these interviews have a tremendously galvanizing effect on one's meditation practice. It is, there's a real connection between the interviews and the way you practice. If you know that your next interview is coming up tomorrow, then you will make a certain, or you will exert some effort in your practice today, and you will observe really carefully so that you will have something to say during the interview tomorrow. Otherwise, you don't, you take your practice kind of in an easygoing way. You just sit there, oh, good feeling, great. And that's it. The first sitting was a big success. And then comes the interview, you go in there and you say, oh, I had a very pleasant sit, and that's all you have to say. Well, there's more to the meditation practice than this. So, interviews really galvanize one's practice. One will be observing carefully. Only when one observes carefully will one have some things to write down, and only then, with this, one will have some points to report. Now, please do see the interviews in a positive way. They're meant to help you in your practice, or to support you in your meditation practice. And don't see them in a negative way. Don't think that either Marcy or I want to make life difficult for you. This is not the case at all. And during interviews, a meditator will report his or her findings, and then the teachers will listen very carefully, and based on what has been said, some advice will be given, some encouragement will be given if necessary. If there are certain mistakes in the way of practice, these will be pointed out for your benefit. And so then, if really necessary, on very rare occasions and a meditator is just not getting the point, then we might say, please, or then we might be a little bit firmer and say, please don't do like this, and practice slightly differently. And so, any advice given, please don't take it as an offense, but rather take it in a spirit of wanting to support your practice. Now, during the initial first few days of a retreat, meditators tend to experience a couple of common difficulties, and among those are what? Pardon me? The hindrances, yes, and what else?
Sleepiness.
Yes, okay, correct, and what else?
Restlessness,
yes. Doubt, yes, and your mind will be very still, the mind will be wandering plenty, there you go. And on top of this, will you be having really pleasant, comfortable, pain-free sits all the time? Not. So, on occasion, some pains will arise, and so you will just have to be patient with those. And gradually, things will get easier. Now, based on all these initial difficulties, what may arise is a certain discouragement. Discouragement with these pains and aches, discouragement with the difficult mental states, and you think, my goodness, why did I come here? I really made a big mistake. And now I'm here, now I'm stuck, and what to do? And so, Don't get, once again, as mentioned early on, don't get lost in the content of your thoughts, and just know, mental discouragement has arisen in the mind. Take the discouragement as an object, label it accordingly, observe it in a detached, in a non-reactive manner, and know its nature. And sooner or later, the discouragement will do what? It will disappear. So just remember this, and then you'll be okay. And so that's is that. And then, in general, a general attitude towards the meditation practice, namely, try to observe as much as possible your predominant objects of observation with a calm and detached attitude. And observe objects with a mind that is relaxed, and yet at the same time that is alert. No, and so you don't want to get tensed up because of your meditation experiences. There's no need for this. And so, experience with meditators over many years shows that the best way to proceed in one's Satipatthana meditation practice is really by staying relaxed and keeping up that alertness of the mind. Now, to end with a few notes of precautions, just for you to know and to keep in mind. Like everything, you know, we need to observe everything in life. You know, we need to observe certain limitations, certain restrictions, and certain, so this certainly very much also applies to the meditation practice. Now, some retreatants or some practitioners on retreat do not drink enough liquids and therefore get dehydrated, especially up here in this rather dry country in New Mexico. And so please do ensure that your daily intake of liquids is around how many liters? So 3 to 4 liters or so? Six, 8 glasses a day. Oh, you could easily be even more than this. Well, it depends on how big the glasses are. I don't know. So please drink plenty and plenty every day. Then some retreatants with regard to food eat very little, or what they do is they eat, at first they start out eating normally, and then they eat less and less, or even start to fast. And this is something you don't want to do on an intensive retreat, since food provides the body with nutrition, and only then will you have energy to practice. And so then, as number 3, some retreatants allow to be constipated for 3 or more days. Please tackle constipation soon by taking natural laxatives or by doing exercises that induce a bowel movement. If you have any difficulties in this regard, please talk to Chris or Marcia or myself, and I think I will probably find some help for you. And then being constipated on a retreat will lead to what?
Discomfort.
Yes, discomfort, physical as well as mental. And this will help your meditation practice or not? Not at all. And then, in the course of an intensive meditation retreat, the need for night sleep will fluctuate, sometimes lessening, sometimes increasing. It is not recommended to deliberately deprive oneself of sleep or to willfully practice through the whole night. Now, we need to distinguish two situations here. One is that a person through willpower says, okay, now let's say, sits down, maybe it's at the beginning of the last sit of the day, and then decides to sit in full lotus posture through the whole night until the morning of the next day, until breakfast. Do you think this would be a really good idea? Really bright, brilliant idea? It's not. So if it's done by willpower, it's obviously not the right thing to do. But sometimes, on certain occasions, the practice is going quite strong, and so it's easy to practice a little bit longer than what the schedule calls for. In this case, okay, follow the natural development and maybe do another half an hour sit or so, or an hourly sit, and then by that time, if you feel tired, then it's time to rest. So sleep is certainly important. Now, some retreatants push through excruciating levels of pain. Now, should a pain become excruciating, please feel free to change your sitting posture slowly and mindfully, and don't overdo this. There is no need to kind of adopt this so-called, let's say, militaristic attitude towards your pains. Like, under all circumstances, you need to win against a pain. But rather, take a balanced approach, and at times the pain may be really quite excruciating. Then do change your posture, and then try again. And at other times it may happen that your mindfulness and concentration is so strong that the pain gradually, while observing it, will subside by itself. Now, some retreatants wrongly assume that thoughts should not arise during Vipassana meditation. This is a wrong assumption. Instead, thoughts should be included as objects of observation. And once you bring mindfulness to the thinking or to the wandering mind, it, strictly speaking, does not qualify as wandering mind anymore, because mindfulness is there. Now, what else? To some new retreatants, it may seem very difficult to sit for the full hour. Kindly sit according to your ability. And so, let's say, if you feel you need to stretch a leg or two, okay, please do so slowly and mindfully, and without disturbing the other meditators. Now, over time, within a couple of days, the body will get more flexible, especially your muscles. And then with this, you will find that you'll be able to sit for longer. So maybe during your first day, you manage to sit for 45 minutes, and then gradually the body loosens up more and more. And then gradually you notice, oh, now I can even sit for 50 minutes. And then some time later, you find you can sit even for the full hour. So go according to the natural development, and don't think that you need to impress others. Now, some retreatants unnecessarily put excessive pressure on themselves by entertaining high expectations in terms of attaining the Dhamma, or by competing with fellow meditators. So, thinking like, during this retreat, really I have to attain Nibbana, and then they start counting, today's day one, and by the time the day ends, oh, Nibbana hasn't been attained. Not on day one. My goodness. Am I going to make it during the remaining 27 days? And with this, your pressure increases day by day. And in the end, you will be like maybe a potato in a pressure cooker. And this is not that pleasant, I assume. And also, there's living in a highly competitive worldly society. People are very competitive. It already starts at high school, and this sense of competition then gets brought into, well, into a meditation retreat. And even though meditators don't talk to each other, they still compete with each other. And so then they see someone else sitting for 2 or 3 hours, and one himself can sit only for, let's say, 45 minutes, and one gets totally depressed over this. There's no need for this at all. You don't know where the other meditator is at. You don't know how many years of, how many decades of practice this other person has already done. So please take it easy in that sense. And so, have entertaining high expectations. This is counterproductive. Instead, take an expectation or a thought of competition as an object, label it, observe it, and know its nature. Some retreatants try to exercise complete control over unwanted states of mind, which of course is not very realistic. And so try to observe those unwanted states of mind with an allowing attitude. And among these unwanted states of mind, we have things like what?
Anger.
Excessive anger, yes, and? Fear?
Greed.
Greed, yes. And then what about worries or fear or
anxiety?
There you go.
Getting into too much joy.
Oh, getting into too much joy. Yes, this indeed at times may also be a problem. No. So, should any of those or others other mental states arise, then try not to control them, but rather just take them as objects of observation and with a detached, calm, and non-reactive mind observe those states. Or if a difficult mental state gets just too much, then you might want to do the following, namely, you simply focus your attention on some bodily phenomenon, ideally on some pain, and then the mind will be much more occupied with this physical object, and this then will gradually lead to a reduction of that earlier mental state. So, some meditators or some practitioners push the mind far too hard into states of extreme fear, worry, self-judgment, guilt, and the like. And this is not necessary. Please try to practice in a balanced manner. And should you be experiencing extreme levels of fear, depression, anxiety, elation, hyperactivity, etc., then kindly inform your teachers without certain delay. So these are just certain precautions that are wise to keep in mind. And then observe objects with a calm and detached, relaxed attitude. This we have already. And then as a last point, in the course of Satipatthana meditation, many different experiences may take place. Each person will experience the practice in a different way. It is important not to develop any expectations as to the way the practice should unfold based on previous theoretical knowledge, others' experience, or one's own former practice. The whole range of human experiences can come up during one's practice, and any object, no matter what it is a great field for observation and a chance to learn and gain wisdom from it. So, to summarize all these different points here in just maybe 2-3 words, it's balanced practice. Please stay away from any kind of excessive practice, excessive attitude to the meditation practice, and then you should be quite okay. Now, let me conclude our morning session by wishing may all of you be in a good position to apply the many instructions that have been given last night as well as this morning, and then may the instructions help you to observe the predominant objects in a clear cut, in a rather distinct manner, and may this then contribute to the arising of much intuitive wisdom, and eventually may it lead you to the experience of the peace and coolness of Nibbana. And this is it.